Hello and welcome to the as yet unnamed London Theatre podcast for the 24th of February 2013. My name is T.R.P. Watson and this week I'm joined by Gareth James, Johnny Fox and Phil from the West End Whingers. We're now going to talk about Macbeth, which is on at the Trafalgar Studios. This production, directed by Jamie Lloyd, stars James McAvoy and as Macbeth and Claire Foy as Lady Macbeth. I thought that this was a very impressive production in many ways. I did have a couple of slight problems with it, partially because I got on a stage seating, which gives you a magnificent feeling of closeness to the action. Unfortunately, I was at the end of a row, and a lot of speeches I didn't see because there was a great big pillar in front of me, which was a pity, and I didn't think I was buying a partially obstructed view seat, so it was a bit of a pity there. The other thing I have a slight problem with is, I think because I've seen a dozen or so Macbeths, and I've seen 200 productions of Shakespeare, and I get very, very bored with post-apocalyptic settings. And this is in a post-apocalyptic setting, which means everybody sort of dressed kind of in kind of rags, and the instruments of royalty are rather down at heel, and, you know, people are drinking antifreeze to get visions, and yeah, it kind of works, but it works in the sense of this is a good production and it's very well acted, but I'm just bored with post-apocalyptic. It, to me, it's the sort of the default when you can't think of anywhere else to set it. It's sort of, oh yeah, well, we can always do that. I think it dates back to seeing a previous production of Macbeth with Mark Rylance, which was a pretty, this known to be a fairly odd production, that one. They wanted it to start off with a Nick Leeson setting. It was about the same time that Nick Leeson brought down the Barings Bank, and they wanted to sort of feature that, and so they made lots of publicity, did all the posters and the programmes with them dressed up like Nick Leeson, and then they realised, possibly halfway through the rehearsal period, that that setting simply wasn't going to work and it didn't make any sense. I mean, it doesn't make any sense now. And they changed it to your basic grungy post-apocalyptic feeling to it, and unfortunately this is much the same. It's sort of, so I kind of associate it with that, and that sort of put me slightly against this production, although the production fights very hard, and because it is so good, there are a lot of impressive pieces. James McAvoy is fantastic, really, as Macbeth. Claire Foy, as always, and we have other people like particularly Forbes Masson as Banquo, very impressive, and Jamie Ballard as Macduff. You know, it's an impressive piece. It's very well put together, and I think for everybody else who isn't bored of the concept of sort of post-apocalyptic grunge, it's going to be fantastic and fine. And I think a lot of people were really rapt by it. And I've seen a lot of talk on Twitter about how happy they are with this production. Gareth, what did you think about it?
Well, I obviously haven't seen as many post-apocalyptic productions of anything as you have, because I don't recall seeing a post-apocalyptic Macbeth. I actually thought, I mean, for me, you know, it's set in a future Scotland post-independence. We've screwed up the economy, we've screwed up the environment, and the Scots have gone all feral, really. So I'm not sure I'd call it post-apocalyptic. I'd just call it a sort of more dystopian future, perhaps. I thought it worked brilliantly, frankly. It is kind of down and dirty in that it's, you know, it's a sort of disused building, and, you know, the props have come off a junk heap, and the clothes, well, they won't be doing any dry cleaning, I don't think. But it's just so wonderfully staged with this incredible energy. And you're right. I mean, James McAvoy is terrific, I think. I think this is a real career-defining performance for him. And it's very energetic and very passionate. I mean, he throws himself around the stage, and the fight scenes really feel real. And, you know, there are moments where you think this is dangerous. I mean, you're really on your on the edge of your seat, because it's feeling very dangerous. I thought the whole stage it was like a thriller. You know, it's a stage like a thriller. I'm not a Tarantino fan, but there were sort of aspects of Tarantino or a horror movie, or, you know, so it was a very sort of thrilling and riveting staging that just had me from beginning to end, really. I was luckier to be, I was on the stage as well, about four rows back, but I was lucky to be on the middle of the row, on the aisle where the actors enter and leave sometimes. So I suppose I had a better view there. I think the intensity of being that close to the action does actually have a huge impact for you. You know, and these are Shakespearean debuts by the director Jamie Lloyd, by James McAvoy, by Claire Foy, if the program is to be believed. I think my one negative about it is that, you know, it is all Scottish. I think it is an entirely Scottish cast, and the whole thing's in, you know, in Scottish accents. I think the combination of the accents and the staging, because people are therefore looking in different directions when they're speaking the verse, and in the case of the witches and some of the assassins, they're wearing masks. The combination of those three things means that it's not really doing the verse as much justice as you might expect. And I think people who really go for verse may well be disappointed. But for me, that's more than made up by the fact that it's a proper Scottish play, and made up for by the staging itself, really. So it exceeded my expectations quite a lot, really. And I was, I walked out feeling great about it. And the audience was younger than average, but quieter than average as well, which was great. And they, you know, because you can see the people, the other side of the action, you know, clearly people were rapt. I mean, there was none of the chattering and rustling going on. It was really, you know, people were absolutely captivated by the whole thing. So I think it's a terrific thing to have in the West End. I think it's a great start to Jamie Lloyd's company there. I can't wait to find out what the next couple of things are going to be. And I think we're just very, very lucky to have it, really. So absolute five stars for me.
Yeah, I mean, obviously I'm nitpicking a lot, and I probably shouldn't. The other thing to bring up, this is a very brisk version of the play, I thought. And I was slightly disappointed that they didn't go for a full, right the way through. I mean, it would have been well over 2 hours if they had. But it felt as if they should keep the momentum going, and the momentum was slightly stilled by the interval, I thought. But I mean, it was because it was, you know, you were so into it, and you really didn't want to stop halfway through, but actually it was more like 2/3 of the way through, I felt.
I didn't think it was that, but it was 2 hours 50 minutes the night I went. And I think it was so exhausting. I think without the interval it would have been quite difficult to keep that going. Maybe it's got longer as the run's gone on. No, I went on Tuesday, which is about three nights before the opening. Yeah, it's the sort of play that would benefit for being straight through. But, you know, on my reading, that would have been 2.5 hours, which I think might have been a bit long.
Yeah, I have seen a version which is done at 2 hours, which was very cut down, but very impressive.
Yeah, I mean, I was reflecting on all the other sort of Macbeths I'd seen, really. I was thinking about, you know, what have I enjoyed as much as this? And I think probably only the sort of Stalin-esque Rupert Gould Macbeth with Patrick Stewart, and the outer joint one in the Woodsons, which was a promenade with Danny Sapani. I think those are the only other two I enjoyed as much as I enjoyed this. And I think, you know, James McAvoy is up there with all the Macbeths I've seen. You know, I mean, people like Anthony Sher and Jonathan Pryce as well. I think, you know, I think this is an outstanding performance, really. And I think what's great about it is it's not in any way starry, you know, not even at the curtain call. There's no individual curtain calls at all. It's just a company. And during the performance, he's not in any way trying to sort of upstage or show off. I mean, it's very much an ensemble piece that just happens to have, you know, some cracking performances in it. And I admire that. I admire that because I think it's all very easy, you know, somebody who's got a huge fan base and who's held up as being everybody's, oh, gosh, look, it's James McAvoy's Macbeth. I mean, it's awfully easy to kind of overplay that, really, but that doesn't happen here at all.
It's one of the things that always worries me in a play, and it didn't happen here, is the Lady Macbeth's mad scene. Often that is... I have seen it once or twice anyway. It has been overplayed. It's sort of saying the big scene. And this wasn't done quite so much. I mean, obviously it is a big scene, but this was done very efficiently and very effectively. And there wasn't sort of any over-egging of it, I thought.
I thought Claire Foy really kind of evolved during the show, really. I thought, you know, her character really developed, and I thought it was a very intelligent Lady Macbeth. And she's actually very young, I think, isn't she, to play Lady Macbeth? don't know how old she is, but she's surely she's only 20s. And I thought, you know, it was a very, 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 very impressive characterisation.
We're now going to talk about a chorus line which is on at the London Palladium. It looks rather an interesting cast. People like John Partridge, Lee Zimmerman, Victoria Hamilton Barrett, and of course Scarlett Strallen, which allows me to wheel out my tired old Strallen hold on the West End line, which I'm so fond of saying to everybody and nobody laughs at. Anyway, Phil, what did you think about this play?
Well, I don't know why I was surprised that I really enjoyed it, but I did. It's strange. I think my fear was being in the Palladium. It's such a huge theatre, and in many ways, I think a chorus line is sort of almost a show that should be in a fringe theatre. Except, of course, you wouldn't fit the chorus line itself on that stage, because it's sort of confessional kind of stories, which are sort of teased out of the dancers who are auditioning for the chorus by the director, who sort of shouts his questions from the back of the stalls or wherever he is. And then they either have do a piece of performance and a story or both. And I think the thing why this really works is that the cast is so well cast. They're all very good in their individual moments. And for a show which I think, you know, has no set to speak of. It's, you know, a bare sort of rehearsal space, black box, which how it's traditionally done. And there's nothing really in the way of costumes until the sort of the final one, singular sensation sort of number. There's not much to look at. So I don't know how they're going to fill the Palladium with a show which is charging, you know, the kind of Palladium prices that you would get. But having said that, it's really good. I mean, we were very close. We had day seats, so we were right up the front, and that worked really well for seeing the performances. I think sort of concentrating from the back of the theatre on an individual sort of in a spotlight on a bare stage would be quite hard work. Everybody's very good. Strallen's very, very good, although I think that her number, I can't remember what it's called, something about the mirror.
Music in the Mirror.
Music in the Mirror. I mean, it goes on too long, and it's very sort of traditional and sort of a bit like the ballet and Carousel. It's not her fault. She does it brilliantly. But I just sort of thought, yeah, okay, I've got the point of that now. I think that Victoria Hamilton Barrett, who gets two great numbers, she gets the Nothing song, which is about the pretensions of sort of theatre workshop type things, and she also gets What I Did for Love. She's a very likeable presence in the show. Lee Zimmerman, as the sort of the dry Sheila, who's a little bit too old for the chorus work anymore, is as usual absolutely terrific, and she's very, very funny. She reminded me a bit of Patsy from Ab Fab. Yeah. And John Partridge is good. I don't really know who he is, but he's pretty good in the part. They all are. I mean, I really have got hardly anything negative to say about it. I just do wonder how it's going to fill such a barn like the Palladium, but that's their problem, really. I think it's definitely worth seeing. And the choreography, I thought, was fantastically tight. And we saw this at a sort of midway preview, and it's so crisp and quite exhausting, especially from close up. You can see the sweat coming off people. So they're working hard and they're doing really well, I think.
Yeah, aren't they using the original choreographer from the 1975?
It's directed by Bob Avion, who was co-choreographer on the original production. He's 75 now. But it's been restaged, I think, by Bayork Lee, if I'm pronouncing correctly, who was in the original cast. I think she played Connie in the very original cast. So, and you know, it's all the original things. It's the original set designer is credited, Robin Wagner, Theoni V. Aldridge, who did the original costumes, is credited, and the original lighting designer, Theron Musa. And the lighting is excellent, I thought. There were moments, particularly towards the end, which were very effective. And I think, actually, I saw it in the 70s in a touring production in Chicago, and I haven't seen it since, apart from the terrible film version. So I couldn't really remember much about it, but it's actually quite hard to forget because it's a very distinctive, and in its day, it was very innovative, the staging of it. So they're not trying to update it at all, which I think is probably a good thing. And it didn't feel in many ways that it dated, which I think was the biggest surprise for me. Actually, one thing I didn't remember, and I don't know if they've added this, but I assume this is how it's always done, is that the one singular sensation number is done, it moves from sort of the rehearsal situation, and there's also a scene where Zach and Cassie are sort of having a sort of a row on stage about why she left him. And the chorus are in the background singing the words very quietly, but they sing sort of left and right for the left and right steps, and with the emphasis on the left because she left him. And there were some little touches like that, which I thought were really very good. And that may sound a bit rubbish, the way I've described it, and you think, oh, God, but actually I thought it worked really well. There's quite nice subtle touches in it.
John, what did you think about it?
I was surprised, really, because I did see this show in 1976, and again on Broadway, and again in London shortly afterwards. And I was very interested in how it hadn't aged, but I had, and my reaction to it had changed a little bit. I'm curious why we think, and I've heard this from other people as well, why we think it might not last a year at the Palladium. It ran 6,500 performances or something like that at Drury Lane in 1976, and it filled that even bigger theatre for... But, you know, quite a long time. So what has changed that makes us think that modern audiences won't be as captivated by it? I mean, that's a rhetorical question. I don't really expect an answer. It is an exhumation. It's not just a revival. It's a fly-in-amber recapture of what this show was in 76. And I think it's very strong because of that. It's great to see how, as a mould-breaking musical, how it really changed the way we looked a lot of how things were staged and sung, and how an ensemble became just as important as any star. I also have to confess that I can't really contribute to the Strallon hold on the West End, because on the Thursday evening I saw it, Ms. Strallon was unavailable, and an understudy took her place, a girl who certainly knew the words and the moves but didn't have any sort of star quality. I was hoping it had been one of those occasions where, you know, you go out there and you come back a star. Well, she came back an unknown as well, unfortunately. So maybe it's just as well. Scarlett Strallon, is it? Is back in the saddle. I really enjoyed it, and I was surprised how much I still engaged emotionally with it, particularly perhaps because Strallon was off. Sheila seemed to come to the fore, be the lead, and certainly got best applause and the cheers and everything when she came out at the end. And it was her, as you say, Patsy Stone characterization that was pretty sharp and firm. And she seemed to be the most three-dimensionally drawn character. And of course, she looks sensational. She looks every inch a hard-working Broadway hoofer. There isn't an ounce of fat on her. She is tall and strong and wiry and tough. You know, having played with Chevelle McKelly in Chicago for many years. I mean, she really is a very, very successful and seasoned performer, and I thought she did Sheila great justice. The other person I thought was very good was Gary Wood as the gay boy Paul, who has perhaps the sweetest of the sob stories to tell about how he couldn't confess to his parents that he wanted to be a dancer and that he was also gay, and when they eventually find out, how they then react to it is really very tender. And he did that very beautifully. And I think, for all I also don't know who the hell John Partridge is, he did the moment he compassed the boy very well also. Phil, can you remember from the previous production whether Zach actually appeared on the stage in the previous incarnation? Because I thought he was entirely an offstage voice, and it was the stage manager who comforted Paul when he breaks down. And I wonder whether the show has been adjusted slightly to allow the EastEnders audience sight of Mr. Partridge and his very impressive embonpoint. I
can't remember either. I mean, I remember seeing it from, actually, which is sort of negates my argument about seeing it from a distance, because when I saw it, I had a, you know, cheap seat at the back of an absolute barn in a theatre in Chicago. And I do remember seeing Zach. I'm sure he came from somewhere and climbed up on the stage at some point, but it's so long ago. I think I saw it in 1978 or something. I think you do see him, I'm sure. But I don't know whether you see him as much as in this. I mean, you've got to see him because he's, for a lot of people, he's the only real name in it, because I think people who don't go to the theatre a lot won't know Scarlett Strallen and Lee Zimmerman and how good they actually are. So, yeah, perhaps they have put him in more because, you know, he's the name.
In the opening scenes where they're rehearsing the song, because I'm fairly sure it was the assistant choreographer, or the choreographer, rather, who was teaching them the routine rather than Zach himself. But he did dance very well. I was quite surprised. Like I say, I don't really know his television work, but he wasn't bad at all. And I think quite a few people were sort of pleased to see him. So yes, not at all bad. I would recommend it. I got a ticket on the day for about £50 in the fifth row of the centre of the store, which I thought was a pretty good deal. So it's not outrageously priced. The thing that really made me react slightly differently to Chorus Line this time around is the X factor. Because, of course, the way in which every television reality show has to have people who are struggling to win the audition and get the role that's offered also have a sob story. And this is where it comes from. I swear this is where all those television companies that have produced all those shows got their idea in the first place. That in Chorus, everybody in the chorus has to have a reason in order to win Zach's favour. And he is the archetypal Simon Cowell.
We're now going to talk about the audience, which is a new play by Peter Morgan, directed by Stephen Daldry, and starring Helen Mirren as Queen Elizabeth II. This is a pretty much a fascinating play. It takes place with the Queen having her weekly audiences with her prime ministers. She's had 12 prime ministers, and practically every week she talks to them. It's not an official thing. It's kind of an unofficial thing, but it usually happens at 6 o'clock on Tuesdays. The Prime Minister goes to the Queen and just talks over what has happened in that week and what they plan for the next week. This is used as a tool to really give you a portrait of the Queen. We know very little about the Queen, but Peter Morgan has come up with some really good scenes between her and her prime ministers, and you really get to... I'm not sure you absolutely get to know who the Queen is, but you get to know why she's there and what she does. And I think this is something where, you know, if you're slightly Republican, you might actually sort of say, oh well, I see the point of her now. I mean, I'm what I call a reluctant monarchist, because I've always seen the point of her, and I definitely felt very positive towards the Queen after this play. It is a really well constructed piece, and really rather fascinating. And it doesn't have all her prime ministers in this. I mean, we have 12 prime ministers, but they don't have Heath or Blair or Macmillan or Sir Alec Douglas Hume. We lose that, and perhaps it would have been very interesting to see her relationship with certainly Tony Blair and possibly Ted Heath as well. It would have been interesting to that, but this would have been an even longer play. As it is, we get some really quite impressive pieces, the performances. I think particularly Paul Ritter as John Major, who opens up the play and really introduces us to it, gets us all laughing. He's a very interesting portrayal of John Major. John Major is a politician, I think, is he's slightly unfairly maligned for some things. I think he was much more effective prime minister had he not been had everything not just gone wrong for him. But he was he's quite an interesting person, and oddly enough, rather Republican in a lot of his views, much more Republican than many of the Prime Ministers. So the other Prime Minister we mostly see is Richard McCabe as Harold Wilson, and that's a wonderful relationship between it. He's apparently the Queen's favourite ever Prime Minister, and we see him in the early 60s being a bit bossy, and then the scenes in Balmoral where they're really getting on with each other, and it's really quite fascinating. We also see elements of the Queen's life with a young Elizabeth, played by one of three characters, and coming in and and sort of questioning her and questioning her role, and it's a lovely interplay between them. And again, this is a I think I didn't quite understand the point of this play at some certain points in it. I just didn't really understand why it's done, but I'm very glad it was done because it's a very good piece, I thought. Phil, what did you think about it?
Well, I'm going to be really boring and agree with everything you've said. There's obviously huge fascination around this, and I think it was quite interesting that the press were in at the first preview, and then there were sort of spoilers in the paper. And I'm trying to not give too much away because quite a lot has been given away about things that they cover in it. I think, you know, firstly, it's an absolute tour de force from Mira, and I've not previously been that impressed with her on stage, but she's absolutely terrific here. And it's interesting because she's playing her from the age of 25 to the present day, and there is a gag that's been obviously inserted in the last few days due to a news event, which I won't spoil, but got a huge laugh. But it's not chronological. A huge amount is required of her. She has to not just change wigs and costumes sometimes, which are done on stage, but she actually has the physical demeanor of her. There's one point where she walks on for her meeting with David Cameron. And for a moment, because physically Helen Mirren's nothing like the Queen, but with the wig and the padding and everything, she walked on and I almost felt, my God, it is the Queen coming on, which is quite an achievement, I think. But even though obviously so much of it is around the Queen, is about the Queen, the supporting players on the whole are absolutely fantastic around her. You've mentioned Paul Ritter, who's the, you know, who plays John Major. And when he came on, he's the first meeting, there was a huge laugh of sort of recognition from the audience. And I think actually John Major sort of being reassessed anyway, there's quite a lot of good press about him now that actually he was quite a good prime minister in many ways. And I think it was quite an affectionate recognition from him. And his first scene is hilarious. But when we see him again, he comes back for a later scene. You can see he's changed from a sort of rather nervous, kind of awkward person into quite a steely kind of person, because he discusses getting rid of the Royal Yacht Britannia with her, much to her shock and horror. And it's a very different relationship. And I think that's probably why Peter Morgan has sadly can't do all 12 prime ministers. Like you, I would like to have seen Ted Heath. I can understand why Blair's not in there, because he's Peter Morgan's already written quite a bit with Blair in. And also, I think by not putting him in, although there are references to him which get great laughs, it's quite an insult in a way not to include him amongst the prime ministers here. And I couldn't agree with you more about Richard McCabe as Wilson. He's got a feeling of Wilson about him, but it's more than that. It's about the relationship with his particular relationship with the Queen, which is quite touching. Yeah, I sort of agree that you don't really come out having learned anything more about the Queen in many ways, but you get Peter Morgan's sort of a version, and it's a very affectionate version of the Queen. And I could suspend disbelief and think, and well, would like to think that that's how the meetings might have been. There's sort of quite a bit of sort of, it's not just politics they cover. They talk about personal issues, health, particularly with Wilson and Nathaniel Parker as Brown. The only one of the prime ministers I thought was a mistake was Jim Callaghan's appearance, which is quite brief, where he sort of appears as some sort of a ghost. I didn't quite understand that. Why that was in there? Did you understand that bit?
No. It felt like an afterthought. And he's not. Jonathan Coote, who plays him, is not really mentioned. Anywhere in the cast.
David Peart, wasn't it?
Was it? Well, David Peart. Sorry, David Peart. Sorry, I misread that. But the It's a pity, because he's obviously an interesting prime minister, and it would have been nice to see him do stuff. But yeah, this play could go on forever and ever if you included the prime ministers they left out. I mean, people like Harold Macmillan. I mean, Harold Macmillan's fascinating. They could have had a longer scene with Anthony Eden, perhaps. Tony Blair, I would have loved to seen. I would love to see a stand up fight, but that's a whole play in itself, I think.
Well, yeah, and also, and maybe he's got that in it.
Yeah, yes, and also there's you know, there's plenty more you could do with Thatcher. And Hayden Gwynn's Thatcher, she's a bit too tall to play Thatcher.
She is too tall, I
but,
think.
But she was rather effective.
She's got the voice and the mannerisms. When she walked on, again, like John Major, there was a sort of a frisson of excitement, because you sort of knew it was going to be quite confrontational, which the scene is. And I think she's nailed her very well. Again, she's sort of too tall and elegant for Thatcher. And I thought the vertically striped suit just emphasised that, and I think they need to ditch that and give us something else to wear. But I thought the thing is, the play is just such a great romp. It's a really good piece of entertainment. It's very witty. The Queen's put-downs are sometimes hilarious. And you get live corgis. What more could you want? I also like the story, apparently, because Peter Morgan wrote it with Helen Mirren in mind, but didn't think she would do it, and said, you know, it's yours if you want it. And she read it and she said, you bastard, because she liked it so much she thought she had to do it, which is I think that says it all, that she could see that this is a great part, and it's, you know, it's going to be such a huge hit. I mean, what it already is, it's
Yeah, I think it's completely sold out, isn't it?
So, well, the whole run is.
Yeah, I'm glad I got to see it. I did take a plunge, although I was sitting up in the gods.
Well, I went for stall seats because they were £49. But even so, I was quite a long way back, which in some ways helped for the look of the whole look of the show, because it does look very. The set's great, I thought, and I think for the likenesses to be further back, close up, you probably wouldn't get the likenesses so much.
We're now going to talk about the Rose Theatre of Kingston's production of Noel Coward's The Vortex. This is directed by Stephen Unwin. It has a fascinating cast. We've got Kerry Fox playing Florence Lancaster, David Dawson playing Nicky, and others such as Rebecca Johnson, James Dreyfuss, and William Chubb in the cast as well. And also an actor who's lucky enough to be able to call himself Jack Hawkins, which is which is a bit of a cheek, really. But I suppose you can do it if the actor has been dead for 20 years. The original Jack Hawkins has been dead for 20 years. You can sort of get away with it. But this is Noel Coward's play. It's his first major success. I think it's about his third play, full-length play. But it's written when he was about 25 and was a sensation, I think, originally. Now, I've seen this a couple of times I think 2002, the Donmar did a version which had Francesca Annis and Chiwetel Ejiofor, and also a production with Peter Hall did about 5 years ago, which had Felicity Kendall and Dan Stevens as Nicky. And it's a very interesting play. I think what I liked about this production, and so it seems as though I'd forgotten what happened. The extra people, the sort of crowd, the chorus, as you might like, which is people like Pawnsfort Quentin and Helen Saville, who sort of are the sort of catty, bitchy people on the sidelines, almost commenting on the action. I don't seem to remember them being quite so prominent as before, and it works really quite well having these people sort of commenting on the action. I think in other productions they kind of felt like as if they were sort of just brought in for comic relief, but they were much more central in this, I thought. This is a tale of a young Nicky Lancaster who's returned from 2 years debauchery in Paris and has come back with a fiancé in tow, although he might have been getting up to other things with a different sex in Paris, it's implied. And he comes back and sort of confronts his mother, who has taken up with a toy boy lover. Also, there's this idea that he's beginning to suffer from the bad effects of drug taking. I think it's cocaine. It certainly looks like cocaine because the way it's done here. I'm not sure if it's actually that in the real case. And it was only sort of I can't remember if cocaine was actually illegal at the time this was written. It was only just illegal.
It had been banned for the troops in 1916. Until 1916, you could buy in Harrods a kit labelled "A Welcome Present for Friends at the Front," which contained cocaine, morphine, syringes, and spare needles. But it was banned for the military in 1916 and for the general public in 1920. It's one of the reasons that Coward wrote the play, because he'd been quite moved by the fact that a young actress friend of his had been found dead in bed at the Savoy from a cocaine overdose. I really enjoyed this production. I thought that it captured very cleverly, I thought Stephen Unwin has really understood Coward's transition from being mostly a very young and callow writer of frothy comedies to an active commentator on something specific. And it's almost as though he's taken his usual coterie of cocktail drinking characters and added a dash of bitters. I'm not sure what it was that motivated the very young Noel Coward to suddenly write a play which had a darker side. But in 1921, he went, he really had no money at all, scraped his savings together and went to New York and learned two things that I think he discovered would serve him for a lifetime. One was that Broadway plays were performed at a much snappier pace than English comedies, and he stepped up his own writing a gear in order to keep pace with that. And also that if you were young and pretty and could play the piano, somebody rich would invite you to a party. And one of the people who did invite him to several parties was a flamboyant and rather eccentric American actress called Laurette Taylor, who was married to a very diffident and shadowy English writer husband, a man called J. Hartley Manners. And Coward repaid them in a way by using their characters or using their marriage in two of his earliest plays. In Hay Fever, Judith Bliss, the scatty and flamboyant actress, and her writer husband David are very definitely affectionate portraits of Laurette Taylor and Hartley Manners. But in The Vortex, it's much more cruel. And one of the reasons I liked this revival was that Stephen Unwin really did highlight the spite in the play. And a lot of these characters are deeply nasty, which you don't normally think of for Coward's writing. And I really enjoyed the way that Kerry Fox, playing the flamboyant and toy boy doting Florence Lancaster, is so much less drawlingly patrician than previous iterations. If you take Mariah Aitken or Felicity Kendall or
Francesca Annis.
Annis was the name I was groping for. And they're really very much far back in the throat, talk down the nose sorts of voices. And Kerry Fox really had a greater earthiness, and she's haughty and she's arrogant and she is more visibly fallible, and I really liked that she it was possible to sympathise with her, but also she managed to look more ridiculous with her young guardsman toy boy than the other actresses had. I don't quite know how that worked well, but it really did. I also enjoyed David Dawson playing Nicky. He was less camp than a lot of portrayals like Rupert Everett or Will Young, who did it briefly in Manchester, lisping his way through the script. And Dawson gives Nicky a layer of complexity. The boy has returned from Paris full of uncertainties. He's spent a year theoretically perfecting his musical studies. He's acquired a kind of standard-issue girlfriend who may or may not be a beard. He may actually have had a relationship with her, or he may be covering up that he might be gay. But it's a much more complicated character, and the complexities came across very well in David Dawson's performance, I thought. It's true that each successive revival of The Vortex, as the years go by, makes homosexual themes even more evident. You mentioned that there might have been a sort of sapphic relationship between the best friend, Helen, and Kerry Fox's character. And I can't believe that's in the script, but I think there is quite a hint in the script that Nicky may have had ambivalence. And Coward, of course, wanted to write a gay play. I mean, he tried for many years to get something like that past the censors, and it just, because the Lord Chamberlain's office was able to rule on everything theatrical, whether or not it could be performed, he never really managed it. I mean, it's said that even Private Lives, although it's about to a heterosexual couple who have divorced and meet their respective ex-partners on honeymoon. It said that was really written for four men. And in fact, after gay marriage, it'd be fascinating to see whether anyone does that as a production. Just going back to the additional members of the cast, I really think that there isn't a flawed performance in it. Those brittle and witty and chain-smoking people that you meet in the first act are very, very well fleshed out by a lot of very good supporting actors. William Chubb, the man who plays the diffident husband, a lot of grace and intelligence in that. And there's a beautiful scene where he tries to reason with and have a fatherly chat with Nikki, but he just doesn't have the social skills that enable him to do that. And the boy blanks him. And that's a really well handled scene. Just wanted to ask you, Tim, whether you felt that the third act, which is the scene in which Nikki confronts his mother and more or less confesses his drug addiction and demands that she drop all her social pretensions and gives him the maternal attention that he feels he deserves. Everyone says that's nicked pretty wholesale from the closet scene in Hamlet, when Hamlet and Gertrude having this kind of argument. But I thought it was just as much Ibsen. Isn't it Mrs. Alving and her son from Ghosts? Isn't that exactly what happens? That she's sort of distanced herself from her husband, and when Oswald was young, she sent him away and shielded him from their family's life, and then he comes back and they have this raw and confrontational argument. I thought that was a big influence, but I haven't seen that in any of the reviews.
Yeah, I think that the closet scene from Hamlet is the one that most immediately grabs you, but when you say that about Ghosts, yes. You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter, on the as-yet-unnamed London Theatre podcast page in Facebook. On the web, we are ayu-londontheatre.org, and the podcast can also be found on both iTunes and Stitcher, where you can leave a review. Thank you. Goodbye.